Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Philosophy in Action. I'm Greg Perkins, here with philosopher Dr. Diana Shea, where we answer your questions, applying rational principles to the challenges of real life. For those listening to the podcast, please join us live where there's a text chat to chime in with your follow-up questions and witty comments. The show airs Sunday at 8 a.m. Pacific, 9 a.m. Mountain, 10 a.m. Central, and 11 a.m. Eastern Time at philosophyinaction.com. At the site, you can also submit and vote on questions for upcoming shows and browse the archives from past shows. Now, with all of that out of the way, let's jump over to the star of the show, Dr. Diana Shea.
Okay, happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday. Welcome, everyone. Greg, why don't you tell us what topics we have on tap this week?
We have a great set of questions on doctrine of double effect, the obligation to report a crime, cutting ties with homophobic family members, and more. Well, maybe not more.
No, yeah, I've got a lot to say on all three of these, and I asked Greg just before we started, you know, do you want to cut out the last one or do you want to go long? And he said it's up to me, and I said let's go long. So that's what we're going to do. So folks, if you're listening live, you can post questions and comments in the text chat over at philosophyinaction.com/live.
All right. Has anything been going on?
Yeah, just a few things. So last week I was over at my trainer, Martha Deeds. We had a clinic with Eric Horgan. He's the guy that I go to Aiken, South Carolina to train with over the winter. And I was riding both Lila and Phantom. And other than my first ride on Phantom, they were really great. They were phenomenal, particularly Lila, man. She just continues to impress. She is outdoing her physiology. So I'm just super happy with her. Also, I've been...
You led with the horse?
Yes, I led with the horse so that I could then do this second,
okay,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I've also been busy with other personal matters. As folks have seen on Facebook, Paul and I have decided on a trial separation. Neither of us has done anything wrong to the other. Like, he hasn't beaten me. I haven't cheated on him. It's just the result of longstanding differences. And at this point, we really don't know what's going to happen over the next few months. We still care for each other deeply. And we're committed to working things out in an amicable fashion. But, you know, we really don't know where it's going. I'm doing okay, folks, as evidenced by the fact that I'm broadcasting today. So please don't worry. And please also just give me a little bit of space on this. I would appreciate that. And so that's it. So with that, sorry. I feel like for those of you who aren't on Facebook, this might be a bit of a shock. So sorry about that. But we're just going to go ahead and get started.
We were shocked, I say.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you guys are doing great. Hang in there. And if there's nothing else, we could get going on this.
Yeah, let's go ahead and get going.
Okay. Doctrine of double effect. Is the doctrine of double effect true? The Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy says, quote, "The doctrine or principle of double effect is often invoked to explain the permissibility of an action that causes a serious harm, such as the death of a human being, as a side effect of promoting some good end. It's claimed that sometimes it is permissible to cause such a harm as a side effect or double effect of bringing about a good result, even though it would not be permissible to cause such a harm as a means to bringing about the same good end." Unquote.
How is
this principle used in analyzing real world ethics? Is it true? Why or why not?
Yeah. So what I want to do is start with a little bit more precise statement of the doctrine of double effect. Basically, this is a way of assessing the morality of an action with both beneficial and harmful effects. So normally you would say it's wrong to do the action if, you know, just for the sake of the harmful effects, right? But it would be okay to do it for the beneficial effects. But how do you judge it when you have both beneficial and harmful effects? And so basically the question is, when is that action morally permissible? When is it morally acceptable? And there's four standard conditions, and these are sometimes formulated in different kinds of ways, but this is actually from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy article. And all of these must be met. So first of all, the action in itself must be good or at least indifferent. So the action can't be inherently wrong. It can't be like raping somebody, right? Secondly, the good effect is intended, but the evil effect is not intended. That's the second criteria. Third, the good effect has to be, it can't be produced by means of the evil effect. So basically you can't do evil for the sake of creating good as a causal matter. And fourth, there has to be a proportionately grave reason for permitting the evil effect. Basically, the overall good of what you're doing has to outweigh the harm that you're doing and has to outweigh the evil. And oftentimes you have to say, look, we need to make sure to try to minimize the evil here too. So basically the idea here is that an action in pursuit of a good end is morally permissible, even if it will produce some harmful or evil result, provided that that evil result is just a side effect and it's not intended, it's not the goal, and it's not used as a means to achieve the good result that you're aiming at. So this is, in a way, this is the opposite of the ends justify the means mentality, where, hey, look, we can do whatever evil we want so long as we get good results. And this, for those of you who are not familiar with this, it's not a well-known doctrine. It's actually a Catholic doctrine. It originated in the works of Thomas Aquinas when he was talking about self-defense and when it was permissible to defend yourself. So that's it. That's its basic history there.
I'm unsurprised about that last bullet.
Yes.
Okay. So let's work through some examples maybe.
Yeah. So these are two fairly standard examples here. So first of all, imagine that you are an oncologist and you are a very strict Catholic. And there's a pregnant woman who has just been diagnosed with cancer. And let's say she's also a strict Catholic, just to make this simpler, because it's not a matter of people having differences of opinion. That's not relevant here. And she's just been diagnosed with a cancerous tumor in her uterus or somewhere, whatever relevant reproductive system.
Lady bits.
Yeah, there we go. If this woman attempts to carry, she's pregnant, right? If she attempts to carry her pregnancy to term, she will likely die, and the fetus will die too, right? But you're Catholic, right? So abortion is just out of the question, both for you and for her, because that's just absolutely forbidden by Catholic teachings. No exceptions, not even to save her life, right? So you're just stuck. You're just going to have to let this woman die, and her fetus is going to die along with it, and it seems completely senseless, right? Well, no. Doctrine of double effect to the rescue, right? So let's say as part of the woman's cancer treatment, she would ordinarily get a hysterectomy. That's actually the best way to remove the tumor. And if you do that, yes, the fetus is going to die, but it's not as a direct intended effect. You're not performing an abortion. And it's also not a means of curing the cancer, right? The killing the fetus is not a means of curing the cancer. Removing the uterus is a means of curing the cancer, but killing the fetus is just this incidental side effect. And so therefore, performing the hysterectomy, even though that will kill the fetus, is morally okay, according to the doctrine of double effect. So let's go through the four criteria here. We see, first of all, a hysterectomy is not something that's morally wrong in and of itself. The goal is to save the woman's life, not to kill the fetus. Third, killing the fetus isn't what actually saves the woman's life. It's this side effect, right? And fourth, the life of the woman is a really weighty concern here. So that satisfies all the four criteria. Okay, let's do another example. This is, again, a fairly standard kind of example. So imagine that you are a general in war, and you are absolutely horrified by the prospect of any civilian casualties. You wish to minimize them as much as possible, and you absolutely think it's completely wrong to ever target civilians. So there's a munitions factory, and you want to bomb it. But the problem is that this munitions factory is in the basement of a big apartment complex. Apparently your enemy knows your moral weaknesses here. And so on your view, right, clearly it's wrong to bomb the apartment complex for its own sake, to instill fear and terror into the civilian populace. That would be morally wrong, according to you. But it's also wrong to bomb the apartment complex as a means of destroying the munitions factory. Basically, you can imagine bombing the apartment complex so that it collapses onto the munitions factory. That would be doing something wrong for the sake of doing something evil for the sake of a good end, and that's impermissible. However, what you can do by the doctrine of double effect, what you can do is bomb the munitions factory and say, well, if we destroy the apartment complex in the process, which is surely going to happen, right? It's the foundation. Then, that's a mere side effect. That's okay. So you can bomb the base of the building, and even if we foresee that this is going to result in the collapse of the building and exactly the same number of deaths as would have happened if you had just bombed the apartment complex directly, nonetheless, it's okay because all those deaths are a side effect of bombing the munitions factory, not a means to your goal and not your direct intended effect. So again, we can look at the four criteria. You know, we're assuming here the war is a good cause, and so bombing the munitions factory is not inherently wrong. Secondly, your goal is to destroy the munitions factory, not the apartment complex. Third, the destruction of the apartment complex doesn't destroy the munitions factory. It's not used as a means, in other words. And fourth, destroying the munitions factory is this weighty concern in war, right? This is something that does need to happen. So basically, the doctrine of double effect says that actions that cause evil or harmful outcomes, they can't be performed for the sake of those harmful outcomes or as a means to some other good outcome. But they are permissible if that evil outcome is a mere side effect of doing something good. So, Greg, you have an initial thought on this that I think is useful.
Yeah, my initial reaction was this just smells. It stinks of rationalistic, intrinsicist rule following and the kinds of backflips you have to do when you're on a program that is just not good for human life. And so you end up with all this fine hair splitting and backflips, and maybe there's a better way to think about it.
Yeah, we can only hope so here. Right? Yeah. I think that's basically the right reaction. The doctrine of double effect, it's this kind of moral hair splitting. By the way, I can hear my echo, Greg. Sorry about that. It's moral hair splitting to allow a person to sidestep the ridiculous demands of his own moral rules. Basically, what happens is that it's clear that applying the moral rules strictly will result in people suffering and dying needlessly. And so the doctrine of double effect is a way to manipulate that and manipulate your rules and get around them in some fashion.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. And that is a sure sign that you should be looking at your crazy moral rules.
Yes, I would agree with that.
All right. So what is the right way?
The right way to look at all this. So undoubtedly, I think it's...
I'll even give you just better.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be perfect, just something better than that.
Yeah, I would agree with that. So undoubtedly, it's important to draw a distinction between different types of foreseen effects of one's actions. I mean, you can do things, you know, you perform an action, and there's all kinds of foreseen effects. And there's a difference between the things that you are aiming at, the things that you are purposefully creating, the outcomes that you are purposely creating, and the outcomes that you're sort of incidentally accepting. You're saying, well, these are acceptable costs for what I want. Or, hey, maybe they are like good side benefits. And if you want more on that, on evaluating those and how to morally judge actions and outcomes and so on, obviously you should see my book, Responsibility and Luck, because that's what that is all about. But we can imagine, like, let's take one of these cases that the doctrine of double effect likes to talk about. So imagine you have a police sniper that shoots a man who's holding a woman hostage, and the bullet passes through her shoulder in the course of reaching his heart. Like, in that case, you can say, yeah, the sniper purposefully shoots and kills the man, but he incidentally injures the woman. And there's a difference. He wasn't hoping to injure the woman, right? He was hoping to keep her as safe as possible. But if we do a right analysis of that, we don't say, oh, the incidental effects don't matter. We don't get a free pass on that injury that's done to the woman just because that was a side effect. No, I think what we need here is a more subtle analysis. We need to morally judge an action in light of the full range of foreseeable effects. So if you've got to inflict harms on people in order to achieve some end, don't sugarcoat that, right? Don't treat that as unimportant. Face what you're doing and defend it as a worthy price for the end result that you're getting.
Yeah, you should be saying this sucks and I don't like it and I'm sorry, but the price of not doing that was way higher, like you and everybody around you was going to be dead.
Right, right. Also, there's often other complications here in terms of moral responsibility. I mean, we can see in the case of shooting the hostage, it's important to remember that, first of all, the woman's best chance at living is for this hostage situation to be resolved quickly. And secondly, that we can also see that the hostage taker is responsible for the terrible position and danger that the woman is in, right? It's much more complex here than mere side effects versus means and goals. That's not a helpful way of analyzing it. And I will say, if you do harm somebody in the process of pursuing a worthy goal, don't sugarcoat that. Don't just treat that as, well, okay, whatever. Sometimes you're going to owe compensation for that, and that's really, really important. Mostly what I'd say, though... is instead of the doctrine of double effect, like, get your moral principles in order, right? If your moral principles are preventing you from acting in a way that's clearly the best for everyone involved, then what you need here is new moral principles. And sure, the doctrine of double effect might get us the right result in various cases. It might say, like, yes, perform that hysterectomy, bomb the building, you know, shoot the hostage taker. But that's very, very ad hoc. It's much, much better to get that right result by applying correct principles in the first place.
All right. So that's a lot to think about. What's the take-home point?
So the doctrine of double effect is a Catholic doctrine used to sidestep the awful consequences of their own moral code. It doesn't capture any useful or important facts about moral responsibility.
Total agree. Okay, and looks like no follow-up stuff. So it's time for the reminder about the tip jar.
So Philosophy in Action Radio, not just the live show, but the podcast too, is available to anyone free of charge. That's because we want to spread rational principles far and wide. We do that with each and every show to thousands of listeners, but we can't accomplish that alone. We do rely on the support of our fans. So if you value our work, please contribute to our tip jar. You can visit philosophyinaction.com/support to send money online or via the mail. We suggest $5 per episode or $20 per month, but any amount is welcome. And also, you can create a recurring monthly tip via PayPal Dwolla or your bank's bill pay. Then you don't need to remember, and you get free access to Philosophy in Action's premium content. And we really appreciate that regular support. Again, you can do that over at philosophyinaction.com/support. One thing before you conga, Greg, I am actually feeling rather unwell at the moment. So I think I can get through the next question, but we might cut out after that because, by God, yeah, something's physically not right with me right now. So anyway.
The obligation to report a crime. When is a person obliged to report a crime? About 10 years ago, as a nurse, I heard a patient planning to do something illegal, particularly to lie to an insurance company about the relationship between her injuries and the car accident so that she could keep all the settlement money. At the time, I decided to disengage, but not confront or report her. I opted for that due to concerns about patient privacy, the nonviolence of the planned crime, and the fact that the insurance company could detect her lie from her medical records. Recently, I've been thinking about the situation again. I'm trying to come up with a principle to apply, and I'm getting all muddled. What is my moral responsibility to intervene or report when I know that another person is planning or has done something illegal, meaning something that would violate someone's rights? Does my responsibility change if it's a friend, assumed in confidence, or stranger, overheard in public? Does it matter if the crime has already taken place or is merely in the works? Where is the line regarding severity of the crime? I'd obviously report it if I heard a stranger plotting murder. Also, what if you might be harmed if you report, such as in the case of a gang murder? Is there some basic principle that can clarify when a person is obliged to report knowledge of a crime?
This is a really great question, and I love how much the questioner has thought about it and thought so well about it. Now, let's look at the legal angle first, and then we'll look at the moral angle, which is the one at stake here. So legally speaking, there is no legal duty to report a crime, mostly. And that's because declining to report a crime to the authorities doesn't actually violate anybody's rights. It's not the same as being an accessory after the fact, like by destroying physical evidence. Instead, a person can choose to report or not. That's an exercise of their own liberty rights. Now, interestingly, the major exception in the current law to this is the duty of doctors, teachers, parents, and so on to report known or suspected child abuse. And I'm not sure what I think about those laws, but it does make some sense given the inability of the child to defend himself or to report abuse. Okay, so that's just all I have to say about the legal side. Let's turn to the moral question, since that's the real issue at stake here. My basic view is that you should report a crime to the relevant authorities if you see one in action or know of one being planned. And so, Greg, why don't you tell us why?
Well, the basic idea is that it's important to respect the rule of law and to support the institutions that protect your rights. I mean, this is how we live together in peace. And you don't want people to innocent people to be victimized either. And that's kind of a, again, supporting culturally what's pretty important to your own life. So yes, these are important and you should be paying attention to them.
Yeah. And I think that's a good starting point, but I wouldn't say that's an ironclad rule, right? We're not Catholics here. There are some wrinkles. Oh, wow. Okay, I think I need to stop broadcasting. I am, like, feeling really unwell. Well, folks, I really did proceed to have a major medical emergency after that. I had about an hour of the worst pain that I've ever experienced in my whole life. On a scale of about 1 to 10, it was about a 15. And I ended up at the ER. Paul came home and took me. And I ended up with two things, not quite sure what it was, mild appendicitis, or at least early stages of appendicitis, and also ovarian cysts. Potentially there was ovarian torsion in there. We're not quite sure what happened or what will happen over the next few days, but I am feeling quite well now. I'm very glad to report, and hopefully I will stay that way. Greg and I got together on Monday the 4th to record the second half of the episode just as a podcast. Thank you, Greg, for doing that with me. And so what follows is our recording of the rest of the show. I hope you enjoy it, and very sorry to all the people who were in the live show for the interruption, but it really was quite necessary that I sign off. Thanks, everybody. Okay, so that's a good starting point, but it's not an ironclad rule, and here are some wrinkles that I have thought about here. So first of all, you are not obliged to risk harm to yourself or harm to others to report a crime, and this would include reporting something like gang violence, where you fear retaliation. It's never obligatory, it's not even in right here, to sacrifice yourself. I mean, granted, look, if you want to stand up to gangs who are ruining your community by reporting them and testifying and so on, major, major kudos to you for bravery, but please do everything that you can to remain safe. I think that's how you do that in a moral way. And also, I would say, please don't sacrifice yourself in a small way. Don't sacrifice yourself by taking all this time and effort to report some very petty crime. Like if a kid is stealing quarters out of the mall fountain, it's just not worth a half hour of your time to go report him to mall security. Right? It's just not worth it.
Yeah. If that's a serious problem, they might institute some system for it. But I think at the same time, it's really important to report a crime if some innocent person's about to suffer serious, serious or bodily injury. If it's something major, then and you're not going to hurt yourself.
Right.
I go to the trouble.
Right. And that's the second criteria here. It's not that you have a duty to help, but as a matter of the kind of person you want to be, as a matter of your character, it's dangerous and wrong to be indifferent to the suffering of innocent people, right? You want to be that better person. You want to be the kind of person who cares about whether innocent people are unjustly harmed or not. And also, I think it's important here to just not be a hypocrite, right? If you would want somebody to step in and report a crime, if you were about to be the victim of a crime, then you damn well better be the person who's willing to step in order to help somebody else.
This kind of goes towards just taking reasonable steps to foster the kind of culture you'd want,
right?
The one you want to be a part of. So do that.
Right. And I do think here there is a big difference between somebody who's planning insurance fraud and people planning murder, right? Particularly if the insurance company has a capacity to defend themselves, to notice what's going on and to defend themselves. There's a big difference between that and somebody planning murder or rape or burglary or something like that.
Yeah.
Okay, so third criteria is that a person might choose not to report a crime, but instead to deal with the matter privately, particularly due to systematic injustice in policing, which is something that America is hopefully confronting right now. We know that the legal system is not always just. We know that the policing is not always just. We know that the prison system does not create better people, and that the juvenile justice system is oftentimes just really, really downright scary. And I think we have strong evidence here, particularly of bias against ethnic minorities and poor people. And so, look, if your neighborhood kids vandalize your car, you might reasonably choose to say, look, I'm going to deal with the parents directly. I'm going to aim to get restitution and to get these boys on a better track, for example, rather than calling the cops, because I think that'll be better for them and better for me. I think that's completely reasonable to not report that kind of crime. But again, the aim there is to get genuine substantive justice, not to evade it in some fashion.
Yeah.
I also think a person in general ought not to report a crime to the authorities when that activity shouldn't be a crime at all, like smoking pot. This has some exceptions as well, but I just, in general, you shouldn't try to get people thrown into jail when they're actually doing something that doesn't violate anybody's rights.
Yeah. The so-called victimless crimes.
Yeah.
It's not a crime.
Right. Now, I do also think a couple other considerations here. I think it might be more important maybe, I'm not sure, sort of maybe other things being equal, it might be more important to report a crime before the fact, if you know of it then, rather than after the fact. So it's particularly important to prevent somebody from being victimized at all if you can do that. Now, that's not to say it's unimportant to report a completed crime if you do witness it, but I mean, particularly that crime victim, they might really need an ally in the form of a witness to get justice. But, you know, if you can prevent them from being victimized, that seems particularly important.
Yeah. Preempting is a nice idea.
Yes. Yes. And all of that being said, it's also important to note that motives here matter. And this is a standard theme on our show, something that Greg and I, we often talk about, that a person might choose not to report a crime for really, really wrong reasons, such as, you know, cowardice or fear of social disapproval. You know, gosh, you might not be invited to a party ever again. They could not report a crime due to moral subjectivism, saying something like, well, who's to say what's right or wrong anyway? Or issues of partiality, right? But this is my friend's brother. I can't possibly report him, even though he raped a girl. Issues of racism, right? I'm not going to report that crime because that nice white boy, he didn't mean any harm. These kinds of issues, right? And there can obviously be bad reasons to report a crime as well, including racism and partiality and bias and, you know, those kinds of issues. So even if in general, you know, one action or the other is the right thing to do, keep tabs on the motives here because they matter. They matter morally.
Yeah, let me see, I can recap that. Don't do things for bad reasons.
Right. That's, yeah.
Yeah. That's right. Never counseling doing something for a bad reason,
right.
Ever.
Doing sort of the right thing superficially for the wrong reasons is still doing a wrong thing. I think that's the important principle here.
All right.
Now, the questioner asked about this, and so I want to at least mention it. I do think the question of what the proper course of action is if a friend confides some criminal intent to you, as opposed to, let's say, if you overhear strangers, that's a tricky question. I think that's somewhat different. That deserves its own question in the queue. Basically, my advice here is do all that you can to dissuade or circumvent the person if they're a friend. And if that fails, you might wish to warn the intended victim. And if that fails, I think it's either you stay away if it's not a serious crime or you report the crime to the police if it's actually serious. But I think one should keep one distance away from people who are eager to be shoplifting or let alone doing more serious crimes like theft and rape and murder. You really don't want to be friends with somebody like that.
Yeah. I like the impulse to preempt them and get them back on a nice course, but boy, that's a serious red flag if you've got someone who's genuinely striving to do something horrible.
Right.
So, yeah, boy. All right. So given those considerations, what do you think about the scenario in the question?
Yeah. So I think given the questioner's position as a nurse, I do think you might have worries, genuine worries here about patient confidentiality. Now, I would really, really suspect that you're protected legally and morally too, sort of just the in your employment, if you are reporting a crime in progress. But I'm not sure of the law, right? I'm not a lawyer. And this is part of why I would recommend actually that what you do here is talk to a trusted hospital administrator or what they call a compliance officer. That person would be able to give you good advice. And better yet, you might actually be able to leave the problem entirely in their hands. That person might be able to pass along information to the insurance company, to even just saying, hey, look, you know, I think you need to look a little bit hard at this patient. Nothing more, you know, no details. That might actually be all that's necessary to make sure that the insurance company doesn't get defrauded here.
Yeah. Or, indeed, they do have they have some measures in place to look for these kinds of troubles, and just getting a little bit of a heads up could be more than enough.
Oh, absolutely. Or that person might be able to add a note to the chart or something just to add just a little bit more clarity.
Yeah.
Now I don't think it's your job to go to the police here. It's the insurance company's job. They can press charges if they want to. And you might want to come forward as a witness in that case. And again, the same considerations would apply there. You know, you need to aim to help the cause of justice, not sacrifice yourself and so on. But it would be your job, I think, more to make sure that the insurance company knows what's going on rather than immediately getting the law involved. Because the insurance company might or might not wish to press charges, but certainly they wouldn't wish to be defrauded.
Yeah, that's pretty sensible. There are people there in your chain of command and in that company who are more than qualified to take care of this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, Greg, you and Tammy, you've called the police on you've called the cops on people a couple times, and these are actually some interesting stories, particularly that creepy guy on the bike path. So why don't you tell us about that? I think that's interesting.
Yeah, it really is. It's rare for us to voluntarily become, you know, get involved with police. They've got the stuff they're worrying about, and generally we're in a really safe, like, Boise is remarkably safe. But we did a month ago, maybe a month and a half ago, have an encounter that fit these criteria, and we did exactly that. We went to the trouble of calling the police. We were doing a nice casual ride on the on this bike path, or it's called the Greenbelt. It runs all along the Boise River east-west for many miles. It's a big centerpiece of the valley here, and we were just casually riding back from the reservoir dam east of town, and up ahead we were going through a park. So the river on our left, park on our right, and this nice wide path that we're on. Somebody up ahead had crossed over. We could see him crossing over and interacting with a female, 20 or 30 yards ahead of us. And it was such a close interaction and familiar looking. It's like, oh, they seemed like they knew each other and something was going down there. Tammy, whose radar is better than mine, could see more clearly that it was, no, that wasn't welcome. At the rate we were going, we were soon approaching, and this fellow crossed over from the other side, coming right at me, and I actually turned my shoulder and braced on my bike for an impact, as I said, sir, don't touch me, as just a general, I was so polite. It was
you were.
I was very firm, though. I don't touch me. I gave him an order. He did touch me. Yeah, he made actual contact, and I was like, what the? And by then Tammy who was right behind me had a foot down, and she was a little less polite, I guess you could say. She was
good,
like,
for her.
Don't touch me, you asshole, or something like that. She went off on him, and he backed off. He didn't make any contact with her, but she was disturbed in her path. She had to get back on her bike and get going. And we immediately called the police, because this fellow had now tried to interact with three people he should not have been interacting with. This creepy dude doing inappropriate things, something uncalibrated about him, high, malfunctioning something.
Right.
And so we stopped to call the cops and say exactly where he was and what he'd done.
Yeah. Yeah. And the point is not to, in that case, like, make sure that he gets arrested or that kind of thing. It's just like, hey, dudes, like, there's this guy out here. We don't want him doing to anybody else what he's done to us, let alone anything worse. Right.
Bad things happen. So,
yeah. And I think that's important, particularly, you know, just to make sure that nobody else is a victim. I actually think that's really important in this kind of case. And certainly I've called the police about drunk drivers and so on.
Yeah. Had someone coming the wrong way towards me on a highway, freeway. Bam. I hit the brakes, waking up everybody I was driving for. And it was a serious red alert moment. And immediately called the cops, because here we've got, again, someone malfunctioning, and it can really hurt someone.
Absolutely.
Called the cops immediately.
Absolutely.
So, you had something like that, though?
I had, this was actually back when I was in high school, and this guy was driving erratically like nobody I've ever seen in my life. I mean, he was clearly really off of his rocker. He was driving an old car. And so I sort of followed him in. He pulled into a bank or a gas station or something like that. And this was in the days before cell phones, right? For those of you who are young, you can barely imagine that this exists, but it was true. And so, I went to the payphone to call 911, and he stumbles out of his car, and he is clear, like, he can't even walk. He's that, like, drunk or high or whatever it is. And then stumbles into the car of some friend. So at least he was no longer going to be on the road. But I at least called the cops and said, like, here's where I am. And, you know, this guy is crazy, crazy drunk. And so, Lord only knows whether they did anything about it, but yeah.
Tammy described one where she actually trailed the fellow just to keep track of where he was so that she could help if something went really wrong.
Right.
After a similar kind of call.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think I think in general, it's really important to have this attitude of, I care that innocent people not be victimized by people who are uncalibrated or dishonest or criminal or whatnot. I think that's an important attitude to cultivate. And not that you need to go around being a superhero, but just when these kind of circumstances to come up, to alert the relevant people so that this person who's a problem can't victimize anybody else.
Yeah. And again, I think fostering the kind of culture you want to live in is pretty valuable. And here, that's exactly what we're doing. It's like, I would want somebody to notify an authority before we come across one of these malfunctioning people, or to stop them before they do something horrible or whatever.
Take home point, right?
Yes.
Okay. So as a general matter, you should report criminal activity to the relevant authorities. However, you should not sacrifice yourself or others in the process.
Excellent. We don't have any follow-up because, everybody's been dismissed.
We're not live. Yeah. God, what a mess that was.
I really like having the posse there in the chat and kind of getting what they're seeing, their comments. It feels like we're flying blind here.
This does, but I also like, it feels a little bit leisurely this morning, or not, well, this afternoon now. It's Monday afternoon. And I kind of like that too, so.
Yeah. Cool. All right. So instead, why don't you remind listeners about your premium podcast on moral perfection?
Okay. So as you might know, back in 2012, I gave a lecture titled "Should You Try to Be Morally Perfect?" as part of the Think series of public lectures that's hosted by the CU Boulder Philosophy Department. And in my lecture, what I did was I explored and defended Ayn Rand's concept of moral perfection, arguing that it's necessary to a happy, fulfilled, and moral life. Now, that lecture is now available as a premium podcast, meaning that you can preview the first 14 minutes of the lecture over at philosophyinaction.com/perfection, and then you can purchase access to the full 90-minute podcast for $10. But remember, if you're a regular contributor to Philosophy in Action's tip jar, it's free to you, and so you just need to email me for access. And one thing I really like about this lecture is that it's a pretty friendly introduction to some of the principles of Ayn Rand's egoistic ethics for people who are unfamiliar with that, but it also has plenty of fresh red meat for longtime objectivists too. So I think that folks listening sort of wherever you fall in that spectrum will find it quite interesting in theory and valuable in practice. And again, you can go listen to the preview and purchase it at philosophyinaction.com/perfection.
Ooh, red meat. I should go and check that out.
You absolutely should. Absolutely.
All right, moving on. Cutting ties with homophobic family members. Should I cut ties with my homophobic family? My boyfriend and I visit my family every year for Christmas, and every year they treat him rudely and unfairly. This is solely because they do not accept my sexuality, and they blame him for it. I have made it very clear that if their behavior continues, I will no longer visit them on holidays. They always agree to my terms, but as soon as we arrive, they immediately go back on their word. To make matters worse, I visited them online I visited them alone this summer for my birthday. During my visit, the daughter of a family friend just happened to stop by. It was very clear to me that this was a setup. When we received a moment alone, I told her that I was in a happy, committed relationship with a man. Her reaction showed that she was entirely deceived. I left the house, and I have not spoken to my family since. I have no desire to have a relationship with them. Should I permanently end the relationship?
So, wow. Wow. I'm sorry to say that your family sounds pretty
that's
awful.
Like cat's mode. Yeah.
Yeah, at least on this issue. And yeah, wow.
So, yeah, my first reaction was that these guys aren't just vicious, but stupid.
Yeah.
Home run, guys.
Yeah. So, from the question, it sounds a bit like you kept visiting them and that you even kept bringing your boyfriend to them despite the fact that they repeatedly broke promises to behave decently. And if that's the case, I think that you were far, far too forgiving in the past. Or rather, what was happening is you were kind of forgiving them without just cause, meaning that they didn't have to actually do anything to earn your forgiveness except make a bunch of false promises yet again. Now, I don't know if that's quite accurate, but that's just something to think about the next time you run into a situation like this, because I think that there's, and we're going to talk about this in a minute, there's a process that you need to go to when people behave very, very badly to make sure that things don't go badly again.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll talk about forgiveness a little later.
Yeah. Yeah. And at this point, after this last incident with this poor girl, right, which was, I mean, it was just awful to do to her, super embarrassing and also obviously incredibly disrespectful to you. I am really glad to hear that you stopped visiting them and even stopped speaking to them, because right now they just don't deserve any relationship with you, and they're really, really going to have to change their tune if they want that.
They're going to have to earn that back.
Absolutely. Yeah. But I don't think that there's a need to permanently end the relationship, to be like, I disown you and that's that, and you know, you're not my parents anymore, that kind of thing. Like, you know, if they're not terrible, terrible people, right, they might come around eventually. So one thing you can do is, instead of, you know, breaking with them completely, is you can put the relationship on ice, meaning you don't make contact with them. You only return contact when there's proof that they are making a serious, serious effort to change. And so, Greg, why don't you tell us how they might prove that, that they're making that serious effort to change?
So what's needed here is if you're going to engage in forgiveness, then you should follow the standard recipe. And there's a few steps here. They need to acknowledge that they were really wrong. They have to, you know, it's like you can't forgive someone who doesn't actually recognize that they did something wrong. So they need to recognize they treated you and your boyfriend wrong, and they need to sincerely apologize for that. And so that's step one, recognize you have a problem. Two, they need to actually commit to you to behave decently, which they've done before. And that's why three, they need to actually demonstrate it with concrete actions. They need a little bit of a track record of behaving decently, maybe in baby steps.
Right.
Because, and they have to be sincere and real about every one of these, given the scale of this. I mean, they've got to do some work.
Right.
And I particularly like your point, Diana, about you don't need to do the whole, I disown thee and I don't have a father, whatever, any of that stuff. You just need to say, that was horrible behavior, and I'm not going to forgive you unless you actually earn it.
Right, right. So what I want to do here is talk about these three steps in a little bit more detail, particularly as it relates to this particular situation. So the apology really is the first step. So it's not like, don't let them skip this step and just say, oh, we'll do better in the future. We won't do that again. No, no, no. They have to really, really apologize. And by that, I mean, they have to say that they're sorry and admit that they were wrong in a deep and heartfelt and genuine way, right? There should be no excuses, no rationalizing here at all. And they should really explain in a good way, in a way that shows insight as to why they were wrong, right? So it's not just, oh, like, I know you don't want to be set. Like, I understand you didn't like this girl. You didn't want to be set up. No, like, this was a way of, like, it was inappropriate for us.
Unqualified apology.
Right. It was inappropriate for us to suggest that your relationship with your boyfriend isn't serious, or to try to convert you to heterosexuality by this date with this girl. So make sure you're getting a really good explanation for what was wrong here.
Don't mean to interrupt you so much. I get worked up about this kind of stuff. This is really wrong. You have to see genuine contrition. They have to, think about what you do if you discover you've done something seriously wrong. You're mortified, right? That's when, and this has happened with my friends, my spouse, others. Like, when it dawns on me that I've been a shit, I'm mortified.
Right.
And I apologize and I explain that I see this. I want them to see that I see that it's horrible. That's an important part of it. They're not going to get better if they don't understand it's horrible. And if they don't understand it's horrible, well, you leave that distance between you.
Right. Right. In fact, I did this mortified apology just like 3 days ago. I realized that I had just been really, really callous and really insensitive to somebody. And so I texted her and said, like, I'm so sorry about this. Like, I know that this was completely wrong, and I don't have any excuse for why I said what I said, but it was wrong, and I'm super sorry about it.
Yeah, totally unacceptable, and I want to make it better, and which gets to things we're about to talk about, I'm sure.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, so if that sincere apology happens, then the promise to behave better in future isn't just empty talk as it has been in the past. That promise to behave better has to mean something. It has to be based on the insight of the apology, right? And I think that to ensure that does really mean something, it's important to ask the person to flesh that out, to discuss details, right? To say, look, this and that and this other thing, these kinds of things are unacceptable to me. They're hurtful, they're disrespectful. And to have the other person acknowledge that and agree, right? So talk about the things that, the particulars that have been a problem, and make sure that they know where your lines are, where your boundaries are here.
Yeah, and also, while you're doing this, you're looking for their integrated understanding of why it's bad, how it's bad. Not just that you think it's bad, but they see it. And you should be looking for signs that they really do see it.
Right. You don't want to have to give them a laundry list, right? If they say, "Well, we don't know what you think is acceptable or not," like, you need to tell us everything. No, no, no. They should have the insight to have changed their views about your sexuality and your relationship. And so therefore certain things should become obviously wrong to them. So don't make them put it on you. Like, on the one hand, you can explain this is a problem, this is a problem, this is a problem. But they shouldn't, they should also have a good amount of insight into the kinds of things that would be a problem. And I mean, you can ask them to say, like, Mom, would you do this if I were dating, you know, if I were seriously dating a girl, would you do X, Y, and Z? And hopefully that will clue them into the kinds of things that would be inappropriate.
Yeah.
Okay. So if that happens, right, if there's a sincere apology and a commitment to act decently, then you can give them the opportunity to show you that they've changed. Now,
And again, they should be eager to do this.
Yes.
Not only eager to show you they understand that, one, say that was bad, and two, to show you that they really understand how it was bad and why it was bad, and they should be eager to show you to go that extra mile.
Right. Right.
Sorry.
Yeah. So don't do this by going for a visit, right? That's the mistake that you've made. Instead, what I think that you need to do is resume contact in a more limited way. So start perhaps by talking to them on the phone periodically. FaceTime with them, with your boyfriend present, right? Don't visit them until they have a stellar track record of behaving decently towards you and towards your boyfriend and being respectful towards your relationship.
Nice. So what do they do? What does he do if they screw up in this process?
Yeah. So honestly, they might really not be perfect in this process, particularly
hard to believe. That'd be a shocker.
Yeah. Particularly not initially, right? Because these are going to be habits that are and ways of thinking that are difficult to change. And they likely won't know what counts as acceptable behavior or not. They're going to need an education. That's going to be a process. So on the one hand, I think you need to be really strict with them about this, about what your boundaries are, what counts as acceptable or not. But on the other hand, I do think you need to recognize that there is a process of change here. And
yeah.
I think
it's like retraining. They have a lot of ingrained habits probably that can jump out.
Absolutely.
So you should be looking for the difference between, okay, that was habit, and you didn't quite catch yourself, and I'm reminding you, versus, no, you're just being devious and vicious here.
Right, right. Yeah, there's like, keep an eye on their intentions, like what they're trying to do, because there's a difference between people here who are trying their best to do right, and they just slip up sometimes, versus people who are giving sort of this illusion of conforming, this illusion of behaving decently, but then underneath that, they're trying to sabotage and undermine you. You know, the people who are trying to basically have their cake and eat it too. And there's a huge difference here. And hopefully that will be relatively apparent to you when you interact with them. I also think you might want to establish a kind of protocol for expressing your disapproval.
Like a safe word?
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
Sorry.
So saying something like, you know, Mom, like when Mom crosses the line and suggests, oh, you know, but like, I wish you would settle down with a nice girl, right? Like, Mom, we discussed this. You know that kind of comment is not okay, right? Just very briefly, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's nice and firm.
I think it's really important not to let anything slide here. You don't, like, don't let it go. Even if you just say, like, Mom, no, right? Don't let those things slide. Don't call them out every single time. And if you can't call them out immediately, talk to them later about it. Because if they're going to change their habits, they need to fix every single time. They need to be doing it right every single time. And also then you can see how they react when they're being called out. Are they mortified? Are they confused? Are they apologetic? Or are they angry and resentful? Right? Again, there's a huge difference here in their attitude that makes a difference in terms of, you know, are they basically just pretending to be decent people, or are they actually being decent people?
Yeah. Really important to monitor for, you know, how the reaction goes.
Yeah, for like passive aggressive snipiness is, I think, the thing to be on the lookout for. Now, I think as you can tell from this, right, putting your relationship on a healthy footing will require tons and tons of effort on your part. And honestly, your family just might not be worth it. Like, some people just stink all around, and they might stink particularly in certain areas, and that's why you distance yourself from them. But overall, like, there's just not enough value there to want to pursue the relationship. And that's fine. I think that's totally legitimate.
Yeah.
So you're going to have to ask yourself, do these people bring you enough value in other areas of your life? Do I like them enough to want to work out my problems? And if not, then really you can just keep that relationship on ice indefinitely. Again, there's no need to disown them or do anything dramatic, right? But you can just say, look, I'm just not interested. And that can be that.
You're not present to be around, so I'm not going to be around you.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep, absolutely.
All right. So That's a lot to think about. What's the take-home point?
So your family's behavior has been appalling, and they should have to earn your forgiveness to have any relationship with you in future. And if they choose not to do that, or doing that isn't worth your time and effort, then you can just put the relationship on ice indefinitely.
Indeed. As usual, no follow-up because no posse.
Too bad.
Yeah.
Too bad.
But we can hear scrolling down.
Do we not want to do any rapid-fire questions?
Oh, well, you want to do a couple? We could do that.
Yeah, why not do? I mean, like, hey, we've got, like,
I've got a few minutes here.
I have no sense of what the timing is here for today. So.
I don't either. It was going to be a long one. Let's just do a couple. Let's see what we have here. 1 second. All right, it's a rapid fire question time where I'll put Diana on the hot seat asking questions from this long and growing queue in any old order I like, because it's all about me right now. Well, I'm the decider here. Let's see. Interesting. I'm considering buying a hemp vaporizer to use to reduce my anxiety. I'm a very anxious person. Would this be a good idea, or would it just be avoiding the problem? Okay, so I'll just throw in that I think I know what a hemp vaporizer is. It's a device used for heating up a hemp pot to just the right temperature to release the active ingredient for the nice feelings, and leave behind all the other tobacco-y stuff so that you can consume the good part without all the nasty stuff.
Oh, all right. So I don't think that this is avoiding the problem. I think that sometimes people can have sort of mental moods or overlays like anxiety or anger and so on. And that sometimes essentially some form of medication is actually good, that it actually helps you deal with reality it's not that you're evading, right? It actually enables you to focus on the facts in a better way. So I don't think this is evasion. I do think it's something that you want to be careful about, just like any mind-altering substance, right? So, and I know people who rational, awesome, moral, sane people who use pot, they smoke pot to deal with anxiety issues. And so obviously it's not something that I've done. I haven't smoked pot since I was like 16. I mean, here I am in the state where it's legal and I haven't even bothered to do it yet. like I've been wanting to, it just hasn't happened, right? So obviously not a priority. There's nothing evasive about this, right? Well, but I do think it's something you want to be careful about.
Yeah, I would just throw in the standard response we have is that no concrete action is inherently good or bad. It depends on why you're doing it.
I don't know, like genocide, right?
Okay, yeah, there's a couple of concrete. Most concrete actions any of us will take any given day are not themselves good or bad. It really is why you're doing it or not doing it.
Right.
And here it's like, okay, if you have something that's driving your anxiety that you should be attending to, then yeah, you should be attending to it.
Right.
But yeah.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's a lot of morally optional things, and I could certainly see somebody using pot to deal with their anxiety in a way that would actually be unhealthy and evasive and so on. And I certainly know, I knew a guy in high school who sold pot to his mom, and it was clear that she was being harmed by her heavy pot smoking. Like, it was clear that she was just mentally stupid because of this. And yet he continued to sell pot to his mom because he needed the money. Like, dude, that's really wrong, right? So there's, and certainly it was wrong of her to be smoking that much, but I thought he saw it very clearly. He knew what was going on, and it was pretty, pretty disgusting. So there's certainly times or situations in which you can say, yeah, this would clearly be the wrong thing to do. This would be evading your problems. This would be irrational and so on. But you can't say that just from a general statement of things. It really does depend on the particulars.
Excellent. And let's see, one other one here. How about this? Do you recommend that one refrain from all contemplation of their own death aside from logistics? Or do you think pondering it is beneficial in some way?
Wow, this is a weird question, actually, now that I look at this one. Like, I know I approved it in the queue, but I must have just sort of gone past me. I don't think you should, like, it's a fact that you should recognize, right? And I think you need to have correct opinions about it in that, you know, you should realize that you're not going to the happy place in the sky with Jesus. But I don't think you should. And obviously you do need to deal with the logistics of it, right? Make sure that you yeah. will and do all those other kinds of things. But I can't imagine that pondering it.
I guess dwelling on your own death could be a little dark, but there is one aspect where just, okay, recognizing that your life isn't infinite.
Right.
will light a bit of a fire under you to make this short life that you have, you know, make the most of it.
Right.
So there's right. that, but that's not dwelling on not existing. It's dwelling on the fact that I exist now and it's not going to be forever.
Right.
I don't know. That's one thought anyway.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's something that, like, it's not that you should ever close off thoughts about this and say, well, I shouldn't, you know, I shouldn't think about this. Right. Let your brain think all kinds of stuff, but don't get obsessive about it. Don't get spinning on it, because it's not helpful. You're not going to be around, so you need to focus.
Why would you be thinking about it? What are you thinking about it for?
The thinking that you need to do in life is about, you know, what you need to do while you have the time. You can't do anything about stuff that happens after your death. So, like, once you're dead, you can't do anything anymore.
You don't exist. So
yeah.
And maybe that's why this seems so weird, because, look, minds have a biological function to guide and sustain your life. So it's a little weird to heavily exercise your mind in the service of not living.
Right.
It's just that's a little backwards. Right. That's probably why it seems a bit surreal.
Well,
the other thing is,
like, what is it that you're actually thinking about? Because, like, there's, in a way, there's nothing to think about. Like, you just won't be there.
You know,
all right.
Exist. That's why it was like one standard answer is, you know, I was like, are you afraid of death? No, I'm not going to be there.
Right.
I might be afraid of the process of dying. That could stink. And I might regret that I had stuff I was working on, and I don't like the idea that I wouldn't finish it, or that the people I care about would be deprived of my awesome, you know, companionship.
Right.
those are not fun to dwell on, but it's like, well, you can't change that. This is one of those metaphysically given facts. Best we can tell, you will not exist at some point in the future. So, live your life now.
Yep, exactly.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good one. I'm feeling all existential now.
I know, I really am.
All right, let's move on. Because it's time for us to sign off from another episode of Philosophy in Action Radio. Thanks for listening. We hope you all had a great time.
So, I have to say, I had a fantastic time, and this episode,
this wasn't
so fantastic, at least not the first part of it. And actually, I told Greg before we got started that when it was time, Greg and I had scheduled, you know, we were going to do this at 3:00 today on Monday. And when this time started coming, I started getting, like, really anxious. I mean, just the thought of being in front of my computer again and dealing with these topics, it made my body is like, oh God, the pain. And I'm like,
very
no,
Pavlovian.
It's like, it's okay.
Yeah. Your lizard brain was making that connection after just one really vivid experience.
Yes. Yes. Anyway, I'm glad we did it. It was very non-painful. So
way to get back on the horse there, Dean.
Yes. Yes. And thank you to our generous contributors, too. With every episode of Philosophy in Action Radio, we bring you ideas that engage the mind and help you live better. Plus, we introduce thousands of other listeners to the principles they need to live virtuous, happy, and free lives. We think that's hugely important, and we do depend on your support. So if you want to contribute, just go to philosophyinaction.com/support.
Indeed. Remember, we welcome feedback on what we're doing well and what we could do better, too. Like, you should send feedback to Diana about getting all ill during the middle of the episode and how inconvenient that was to have to, you know, wait for the rest of this.
Yeah.
Just send that to Diana@philosophyinaction.com.
And if you do want to see what's on tap for the next few let's try that sentence again. If you want to see what's on tap for the next few weeks, visit philosophyinaction.com/upcoming. Now, I'm supposed to do part two on my series on miracles for my philosophy of religion series on Thursday, but honestly, I'm not sure that that's going to happen. That might get bumped to another Thursday. Sorry. Like, you know, just way too much has been going on in my life, and there's still there's still a prospect that I might, you know, surgery might happen later this week. So, you know, I'm just trying not to burden my schedule. So we'll see what happens.
Probably just as well. I'm Greg Perkins, and you can find me online at objectivismseminar.com. The show features Dr. Diana Shea, and you can read her blog Noodle Food at philosophyinaction.com/blog. Please drop by to submit and vote on questions for upcoming shows, and then join us live here at the same time next week at philosophyinaction.com.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.